this week, we're joined by a man who loves broth, apocryphally. It's Tim Roth, star of Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man, plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. I would once again like to wish a very happy birthday on this glorious Friday the 13th to everyone's favourite masked maniac, Jason Voorhees. Actually, he's not. He's killed loads of people. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. It is Jason Voorhees' birthday, folks. It is the second Friday the 13th of the year. I'm very, very excited about it. I'm joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. How are you planning to celebrate Helen O'Hara?
Thanks for planning to celebrate me. Hi. Wait, is his birthday...
Helen O'Hara?
Damn it.
Is his birthday every Friday the 13th? Canonically, apparently, he was born on Friday the 13th, Friday the 13th, 1946.
Okay, but a month? I mean, traditionally, birthdays have a month also.
It was...
How do we figure out his star sign?
It was sometime between
Helen,
January...
He's clearly a Scorpio.
June! James is now fully on board.
In that case, I'm not going to celebrate his birthday in that case.
Why not?
March. Because it's 3 months early.
But it's Jason. He's like the queen. He has like lots of birthdays.
Oh, every Friday the 13th is his official birthday.
Is an official birthday. I mean, he's already had one this month, this year, because, you know...
February.
Of the way that the calendar falls. Yeah.
Mm. I will celebrate by ignoring him completely.
Well, how he gets you. Ben Travis, who is the nicest serial killer in the business. Jason, of course, isn't a serial killer. He's a spree killer. It's completely different. Ben, how are you celebrating Jason's birthday?
Might go to an ice hockey game. I hear he likes that kind of thing. we can go ch-ch-ch, which I believe is how you cheer
at
ice hockey games.
That's his theme tune. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's not what anyone is thinking about for ice hockey these days, just FYI.
FYI. I don't think Jason's ever seen an ice hockey game.
What if you do a series of spree killings? Doesn't that make you a serial spree killer?
Yes.
Surely there have been multiple sprees. A series, you might say, of sprees.
Oh, okay. What is the difference between a spree killer and a serial killer?
Much like when you buy insurance online, it's all about the cooling off period, apparently. So spree and serial killers differ because spree killers commit multiple murders in a short time across different locations without a break. So that's crucial, without a break.
Okay.
Serial killers murder 2+ people over time with emotional breaks in between, presumably for their own mental health.
Well, he has emotional breaks
between sprees.
But that's because he's dead. And he has to have time to regenerate and come back and then kill people.
Spree killings are often driven by rage, where serial murders are typically motivated by fantasy or compulsion.
So he definitely is. He's motivated by rage. He wants to get revenge on the people who killed his mum.
But he's also clearly compulsive about it.
He is compulsive. Mm. But he does tend to focus his attacks in one area. Most of the time it's Camp Crystal Lake.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's Manhattan.
Sometimes it's space.
It's a nightmarescape where he goes toe-to-toe with Freddy Krueger. The man's got moves.
Mm. Mm. The cooling off period presumably means if you kill someone and then regret it within 14 days, you can kind of take back
the receipt. Yeah, absolutely you can. Anyway, James is here.
Hi.
James Dyer is here. James, you want to know your nickname this week?
No.
Okay.
What is it?
All right. Well, okay. So this one comes from Sanatos. And if you don't know, if you're listening to the show for the first time, thank you for making it through the first 5 minutes. I nearly didn't. James used to have a nickname, and that nickname is now passé. We're asking people to contribute nicknames for James. We're trying to find one that sticks. He's rejected violently, like Jason Voorhees level of violence, every single week, people's suggestions for nicknames. This week is going to be no different. It's from... Sanatos on Blue Sky. After James turned down another nickname last week, I have a suggestion. Since the Kamino Kid came from Star Wars Episode 2, Attack of the Clones, 5 stars, says Empire Magazine, I wanted to stay with the theme of planets from that movie. How about... And I'm not happy about this one either, so I don't know what you're going to feel. The Geonosis Jesus.
I mean...
It needs work.
It needs work.
I think there have been others, but that's the first one my eyes alighted on.
Geonosis Jamesus would be more acceptable.
Jesus. No.
I don't know. Maybe get your thinking caps on, folks, and think about, you know, what do we know that James likes?
Swords.
He likes judging things. He likes swords.
Yeah.
He likes walking around camps with a mask
only
on, killing people.
On
he
weekends.
Likes Dune. He
Taylor Swift.
He likes potatoes. He likes, what is it? Cheese. He likes cheese. So get these are all the things we know about James.
My favorite, I think I might have said this before, my favorite nickname that came organically out of this podcast was from Ben when we were doing... when we were doing Loki, and you referred to me as He Who Explains, yes. Which I thought that was a good one. But I don't wish to adopt that as my nom de guerre. I'm simply saying it was pretty good.
All right. Well. Okay. Keep them coming, because we haven't found it yet. But the Geonosis Jesus has been finally rejected, I think, by everybody
here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's, all right. That's just
the Geonosis
terrible.
Bit. Great. It's yeah. then the Jesus element. I think yeah. needs a rethink.
He's not sufficiently hirsute.
That's true. Mm. I don't have messianic hair.
Mm.
Shall we have a question?
Why not?
All right. This week I asked our Discord channel. We have an official Discord channel for questions. We have one. Here it is. It is from Neil Parks. My eyes have alighted on this one. With Project Hail Mary out next week. I'm afraid to say he's used the words Mount Rushmore. I didn't ask for this. This is something that has happened. This is independent of me. Mount Rushmore of movie astronauts. Now, this is interesting. We did the Mother's Day question a week early. We're doing the movie astronauts question a week early. We're getting ahead of ourselves. All right. You know how Mount Rushmore works. We do one every now and again. We do, genuinely. We haven't done one in weeks.
We've done them 2 weeks running on the Pilot TV podcast.
Have you?
Yes.
I mean, I know you have. And the subjects were, remind me again.
We did the Mount Rushmore of TV composers.
TV composers.
Barry McCreary.
Yes, indeed. That was my
okay,
pick.
So I know you. I know 8 things about you. You like cheese. Yeah. You like June. And you are incredibly... specific about your tastes in television, so you will not have gone for Ronnie Hazelhurst, and you should have gone for Ronnie Hazelhurst.
No, but that did come up.
All right, Boyd, did Boyd bring that up? Did Boyd bring up Ronnie Hazelhurst?
It was either Boyd or it was one of the listeners. I can't remember.
Tony Hatch? Did Tony Hatch get mentioned?
Possibly.
Oh my God, you guys!
But I went Bear McCreary. Apologies to Ramin Djawadi.
Pilot TV was bringing a knife to a gunfight. The other one was the other topic, the other subject.
We did a Mount Rushmore of it was an International Women's Day thing, and it was connected to TV female leading roles. So iconic female TV leading.
I mean, that's
roles.
A bit broad.
That's very broad.
I mean, it was very broad. I mean, literally.
Yeah.
But I was like, I did not feel as a man I should be naming the
all
iconic.
Right. Mm. Helen, go right now for your best for Mount Rushmore of female leading roles on television.
Yeah.
What do you say, Mariska Hargitay as Captain Olivia Benson in SVU? Okay. All right. That's one.
Lorelai Gilmore, Buffy.
Buffy was my choice.
Yeah, Buffy is the correct answer, actually.
Although I would say Kate Mulgrew, Captain Catherine Janeway, and I forgot to say that when we discussed it, and it upset me afterwards because I'd forgotten.
Yeah.
Rosalind Roslin. Laura Ros.
Oh, no, Starbuck. And although is that a lead? I mean, it's an ensemble.
It is. Yeah.
It is an ensemble.
It's a toughie. It's
which
a toughie.
Is why she was disqualified.
Her from Happy Valley.
Yeah. Do you know what that would have
Sarah
been?
Sarah Lancashire
didn't come up, and she should have done.
It's a great, great character.
There's some British erasure going on in the Pilot TV podcast, not even mentioning Ronnie Hazelhurst. How dare you? Shame on you.
Why are we relitigating Pilot instead of answering our own
questions? I'm enjoying this extended plug for the Pilot TV podcast.
Oh,
thank you, Chris. It's good.
Damn it.
Chris, you know what's handy is because Chris was on the Pilot TV podcast last week, sort of Pilot mega fan Chris Hewitt.
I've warmed to it.
Yeah, he's now a fan.
There was a real upturn in quality last week for about 15 to 20 minutes.
Okay.
And then it plummeted again. But I think it could be. It shows promise. And this is, of course, this is the 9th thing I know about James Dyer. He will never stop banging on about the fucking Pilot TV podcast.
Wow.
Anyway. Back to this
20
podcast.
20 years, you've learned so much.
Oh, so how long have I known you?
No, 25.
25.
It's been 84 years. All right, so let's go back to this podcast and this week's Mount Rushmore question, which is movie astronauts. He also said we could do Ryan Gosling characters, but I prefer movie astronauts.
Mark Watney. Mark Watney.
Shall we define what an astronaut is?
What, for the purposes, is Luke Skywalker an astronaut?
No, obviously he's not an astronaut.
No, don't be silly.
He's in space.
Should we look up, what's the definition of an astronaut?
Do they have to have a helmet?
I'm going
to
look it up.
Is that what we're saying?
Well, hang on, steady.
Whoa, steady. I think there should probably be, ideally, a NASA patch involved, or...
You're so America-centric.
Well, yeah, but they're cosmonauts if they're from the USSR.
They would have a NASA patch, surely.
No, they'd have a what do you call it? Space nut.
A patch, a Russian patch is a patch ski.
Oh, good Lord.
Wow.
The point is, they are called something else. They're called cosmonauts and, or astronauts.
And the European astronauts are called?
Well, astronauts.
Euronauts.
So, wait. No.
Really? No, they are.
Really? Mm. Oh, that's terrible.
It is.
I'm going to disqualify them just on that basis. That's just awful. But international, like, you know, sort of co-productions are allowed, I feel like. As long as it's sort of, you know, vaguely grounded in
If they're in
reality.
Space and they've got a helmet and they're floating around a little bit, I'm going to allow it.
Yes.
If they're in something like a Dune or a Star Wars, I'm not going to allow it.
So more grounded sci-fi we're talking about here.
Grounded.
So like Sandra Bullock in Gravity, yes.
Has a helmet.
Yes.
Grounded is maybe not the right word, actually.
No, not in her case.
Captain Picard, no.
No, he's not an astronaut. Although the definition of an astronaut, according to Google, is a person trained, equipped, and deployed to command, pilot, or serve as a crew member of a spacecraft. Fucking hell. Derived from Greek words for star sailor.
Okay.
Working for agencies like NASA or ESA. They perform scientific research, maintenance, and spacewalks in microgravity, enduring high risk and physically demanding conditions.
That I wonder if really this is they have to like at some point be floating in zero G in the ship or externally from the ship in a suit. Because if it's like we've got the anti-grav on all the time and we're kind of just living in this ship that happens to be in space, that's giving astronaut less than to get through this corridor, I have to float and fly like I'm swimming.
I reject your gravitational bias. I would say Ripley has an excellent spacesuit, therefore is an astronaut.
She does some floating, though.
So you're saying spacesuits are the difference? But then they have spacesuits.
I'm all about the spacesuits.
But they have suits in Star Trek.
They do, yeah. They don't use them often, but they do have them.
She does wear a spacesuit.
When does Ripley float?
Ripley?
I mean,
isn't there a little bit of floating at the end when she battles the alien?
I don't think she floats.
Little...
No, she doesn't.
There's no floating.
No, we don't float in space. Not in these movies.
They probably do a little bit of bouncy walking on the planet when they go
in. LV-426 has quite dense gravity, so there's not a lot of bouncing. Sorry.
God damn it.
Yeah.
Well, they're not astronauts.
But also, and also Ripley doesn't actually.
Ripley!
She doesn't take part in that expedition.
No, but she does. She rocks the spacesuit at the end.
She does rock the spacesuit, but does that make her an astronaut?
Yes.
Yeah, look, you cannot answer every single freaking question with aliens.
Watch me!
Ugh.
That's the 10th thing I know about James. He's only seen two movies.
And they're both
Aliens
the
and
films.
Die Hard.
Aliens and Aliens, the extended
Correct!
So, yeah.
Mm.
Okay, Hellspell, so you immediately went straight in with...
Mark Watney, space pirate. From... The Martian.
Matt Damon. As Mark Watney.
Yes,
Mars colonist,
Mars space pirate.
Mars pooper.
Mars survivor, Mars pooper.
Yeah.
He is an inspiration and I love him a lot.
And is that your choice? Are you happy with that choice?
I think I am. Yeah, I think I am.
What about Sandra Bullock?
Love Sandra Bullock. I think she's fantastic.
I really like Sandy in that one. And of course, George Clooney,
who would rather float away into space and die than spend 5 more minutes with a woman his own age.
Ouch. What's that from? That is
Golden Globes when Tina Fey and Amy Poehler hosted.
Genuinely funny.
Amazing joke.
Very, very good. All right, Ben.
I was going to ask, am I allowed Wally? But instead, I am simply going to demand Wally.
Absolutely
no.
not.
He
no
blasts into space. He floats around.
He's not an astronaut.
He's not an astronaut. He's a robot.
Okay. So in Ben's defense, you're saying that the fire extinguisher sequence qualifies him as an astronaut because he does an EVA.
And the fact that he begins on Earth, blasts off with a spaceship.
He might have you on a technicality.
He does an EVA.
In Ben's defense, he's only seen 3 movies. Aliens, Aliens, the special edition, and Wall-E.
And Wall-E.
So, yeah.
I thought I completed it by that point.
Cinema, done.
Yeah, it's like Michael Owen. He saw 8 films. He was like, I'm done.
But
I'm
he
done.
Is fundamentally a robot. Like, I love him. I love him a lot, but he is a robot.
He prefers the term artificial person himself.
Okay, either way.
Does he?
He is not a human being, which astronauts racist. Traditionally are. Yeah, you know, with the astronaut thing.
Fine.
I'm sorry, Ben. I'm rejecting Wall-E.
We're rejecting Wall-E, and you shall all be cursed for that forevermore.
Fair enough.
Cooper from Interstellar.
Oh, you're just saying names now. You're so angry about the Wall-E thing.
I'm upset, and the only thing that will give me solace is the fifth dimensional bookcase of love.
Yeah,
and no other astronaut has been there.
It's a good choice. That is a good choice. Brandt would also have been a good choice.
Which one was Brandt?
That would be Anne Hathaway.
Anne Hathaway.
Okay.
But she doesn't hide behind the IKEA bookcase of love.
No, she doesn't.
So I think that's a good choice. Yeah. In fact, I think that choice is all right.
All right.
All right.
All right.
All right.
Wow.
All right.
All right. Good. All right. So 2 down, 1 more to go.
I need an astronaut. Brad Astra is sad Astra about his dad Astra in Ad Astra, except that film's really fucking boring, so we're not going to choose that.
I like that film a lot.
I know you did, and that's lovely. we're not having him. Instead, I'm going to pick Cillian Murphy from Sunshine on account of him having the raddest spacesuit of them all.
Sunshine.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. That's it. That's your choice.
That's my choice.
Dr. William Kappa?
Kappa.
Is it William Kappa?
I don't know. We're not on a first.
Robert Kappa.
Basis.
Robert Kappa. No, that's a photographer.
Does he have a first name? I
he
think
has
he's
a
just
name.
Kappa. It's a bit like Beyonce or Wong. You know? He's just Kappa.
Kappa, Sunshine. Sunshine. Robert Kappa.
Amazing.
Bobby K.
Bobby C.
Yeah, as he's known.
Oh, is it Kappa with a C?
Yeah, he's C-A-P-A. Yeah, Cillian Murphy.
Yeah.
By order of the Peaky Blinders.
Indeed.
Uh-huh.
And what is the sun if not the blindingest Peaky Blinder there is?
It is Peaky Blinding. That's why you can't look at it through the window. It's true.
Otherwise you become Scary Mark Strong.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, Pinbacker.
Pinbacker.
Yeah. This raises a very interesting question. Jason Voorhees has been to space.
Yes, he
is. Is he an astronaut?
Yes.
No.
If I'm not allowed Wall-E, you're not allowed fucking Jason Voorhees.
Does the mask count as a helmet? I'm saying yes.
I don't know that he's still human, so I think
again,
we can
with
get
the
him
racism,
on a technical...
What is wrong with you?
What do you mean? Of course he's human. He loved. He had a mum.
If he died a bunch and came back to life, without assistance of like CPR or other medical intervention, I'm saying he's maybe like some kind of malignant spirit or something.
I love the way that you're like gatekeeping space from robots and now the dead.
No. Yeah. I'm just saying we don't call them astronauts.
He's a zombie. Oh, actually, he doesn't breathe. So therefore... I'm sure that's not a qualification for being an astronaut, by the way.
I feel like it is, actually.
Yeah,
I think neither did
George Clooney at the end of Gravity. So.
Oh.
Well, we don't know that. We don't know that. Gravity's real time. Gravity's real time. Spoilers, by the way, for Gravity. Gravity is shot in real time, pretty much, right? By the time Sandra gets down to Earth, he is still going to be floating around in space. Unless he ran out of air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you were in that situation, right? So like a Clooney situation or Favs in Deep Impact where you are, you know, you're being shunted off into space, floating until your air runs out, would you just take the helmet off and end it quickly? A serious question. I want to ask you that.
I'm not sure decompression would be a delightful way to die.
No.
But would you freeze to death?
I think suffocation might be... preferable
yeah.
Really?
Than like exploding. Did you not watch Event Horizon?
Would you explode?
Well, not literally explode, but you know the scene from Event Horizon, basically like expel all the air from your lungs, like cover your eyes and orifices, and then it all goes a bit...
Yeah, well, not the orifices. You don't want anything happening there.
No.
Also, I feel like you'd go all like cold and crispy, and then if like a bit of debris hit you, you'd just shatter into
like the T-1000.
Which again, not a fan.
That you know what? Yeah, but loads of people have died from suffocation. You'd be the only person in the history of civilization to have died that way, and that would be fucking cool. You could high five yourself with your own, severed hands.
Well, I mean, they'd shatter.
Yeah. Making it worse. Yeah. No, I don't. Right. I think you haven't thought this through.
I haven't thought it through. No. But anyway, let's get back to my choice. And I'm not going to go for Jason Voorhees. I'm not going to go for Dr. William Weir, even though he has an excellent spacesuit. You have all, because you were Philistines, forced me to choose Dave Bowman from 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Unfortunately,
I was hoping somebody would, but I wasn't
disqualified on Ben's point that it's, you know, obviously because they use the rotational centrifugal force to create artificial gravity, therefore walking around, not floating around, therefore disqualified.
No, but only like one tiny bit of the ship.
I'm just saying, if you can jog, then you're not.
Well, there was also gravity and sunshine.
Yep.
Shut up, Helen.
I disagree mainly just because I'm Team Hal. You're allowed, Dave.
You love a robot in space,
oh my
don't
God.
You?
I just think he had everybody's best interests.
Yes.
Except famously. For killing them.
Well, they had it coming.
It was a mercy.
They had it coming. They had it coming. They only had themselves to blame.
Oh, good God, we don't have a PRS license.
Had been there, if you would have seen it, I betcha you would have done the same.
I mean, we would be sued if that sounded anything like the actual song, but luckily it didn't, so we're safe.
Lipschnitz. Boom and
Daisy.
Sandra Bullock. Sandra Bullock.
I now know why I didn't go to the theatre with you.
Chicago, except it's just called Space.
Space. Excellent stuff. All right, so I think our Mount Rushmore of astronauts, unfortunately, they're all wearing their helmets, so we can't see their faces, so it's just four helmets up there. Stop it! It is Mark Watney from The Martian, Cooper from Interstellar, Dr. Robert Capa from Sunshine, and Dave Bowman. My God, this Mount Rushmore is full of stars. From 2001, A Space Odyssey. That's solid.
Quite male.
Congratulations to men.
Well, the history of space.
We discussed Sandra Bullock at length.
We did.
As I am wont to do. But that's what we've gone for. That's what we've done. I hope you're happy with yourselves.
And that list might change, I don't know, next week, but it hasn't changed yet.
Yeah. All right, let's move on, shall we? Let's move on to movie news.
Can we talk about some theatre news first?
Oh my God, what is this? The Empire Theatre podcast?
I mean, it really could be. We're extremely cultured here.
We are extremely cultured. Me and Helen could be the theatre correspondents. James could be outside, gaze in at a little through a little window, trying to sneak a little peek.
Your new catchphrase could be razzly dazzle.
Oh my God.
No, this is the news that Quentin Tarantino is going to write and direct a play set to debut in the West End in 2027, and it's called The Popinjay Cavalier, which is, that's a title, isn't it?
That's a title.
It's certainly a title. This is meant to be inspired by swashbuckling epics of stage and screen. It's a rambunctious comedy. It's also been described as a classic farce.
By Quentin Tarantino.
I mean, pretty much, yes. A sweeping celebration of theatre and its heightened romance told with Tarantino's signature style and unmistakable wit. So, you know, that's a thing that's happening. Obviously, as the author of Quentin Tarantino Dictionary, on sale now in all good and evil newsagents and bookshops, I'm extraordinarily excited.
What was your P? Because this would be P now, right? I guess Pulp Fiction.
There's more than one per letter. I don't have to choose just one, you know. Because, yeah.
This is exciting.
I'm truly terrified at the prospect of who Quentin Tarantino will cast as himself in this play, because you know that's going to happen. There's going to be like a 15-minute segment that's like Tarantino doing a crazy accent. And you're like...
Well, he was on stage in Broadway in the 90s and got very bad reviews.
Didn't he do Wait Until Dark?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he wasn't, to be fair, I did read like a good review going, y'all just hate him. Y'all are haterators drinking the haterade.
I do think that if Quentin Tarantino delivered a genuinely Oscar-worthy performance, a lot of people would dismiss it anyway. Yeah.
But I think, and it was that period where he was turning up a lot in different things, acting a lot. But at the same time, I don't know that he's planning to act in this. I would be very surprised if he was. I think what's more interesting in terms of casting is going to be, does he go for the sort of young, fairly unknown theatre actors, or does he go like big stars that he can attract? And either way, the scrum for tickets is going to be insane.
I really do respect his commitment to doing anything but making that 10th film. Like the level of side quest that he is on at the moment.
He's like, this is not technically a film, so I can now do loads of these.
If he was serious about that, I think he should make Kill Bill Volume 3, because according to his own logic, that wouldn't count as one of the 10.
I mean, that's true. But then you'd have to call the whole bloody affair just part of the bloody affair.
Two-thirds of the bloody affair.
Yeah.
I am excited about this, though, because I have come around on The Hateful Eight. I did not like The Hateful Eight when I first saw it.
Love The Hateful
Eight. And I've really come around on it. But that is the closest thing we've got to like a Tarantino play. It is a bunch of characters all in one room. That really could be staged.
Or Reservoir Dogs as well could easily be staged.
Yeah, I think Hateful Eight even more so, though.
It has been staged. Michael Fassbender did a version of it when he was a student.
Yeah. But I do wonder about the specific genre here. This is not a sort of Tarantino core kind of a genre. That's going to be very interesting.
This feels more like one of his Four Rooms episode, almost in a way, like kind of farce.
Yeah,
broad
that's
comedy.
True, but that was even that was more crimey than this sounds like it's going to be, right? I mean, Popinjay and Cavalier, this that's to hints at.
I'm sure there'll be a dreadful murder in it somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure there will be, but like, I don't know. Those words to me say 1800s. They do not necessarily say modern day setting. I know not all of his films, of course, have been, but neither do they scream crime, which most of his films to one degree or another have been.
It could just be a very non-literal thing, like Reservoir Dogs. You know, it could just be an abstract title that could apply to anything, because you don't really know with him, do you? Because a lot of his titles are quite, you know, plucked from the ether. So I wonder if it is quite as literal as... I mean, it might just be him wanting to explore a different space, which, you know, I would applaud. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think they're quite specific words, though. Do you know what I mean? Like
Popinjay. I love the word Popinjay. Yeah, we should bring back the word Popinjay.
If we seed it now, then through the Tarantino play by 2027, Popinjay's everywhere.
Everywhere.
Absolutely.
And if I say Cavalier, it just reminds me of the dancing Cavalier in Singing in the Rain.
Oh, I see. I went Vauxhall Cavalier, but you know, you do.
Wow. I mean, maybe that's what they're talking about. It's a car that thinks highly
of
itself.
It's like a Pimp My Ride type. I get it. I'm there for that.
You uncultured swine.
If it is a Pimp My Ride farce by Quentin Tarantino, I am so there.
Maybe James is a Popinjay Cavalier.
Like that my new nickname.
Yeah.
The Popinjay Cavalier. No.
Better than the Geonosis Jesus.
Yeah, probably.
I think. But I'm excited about this. I think it's going to be great. I'm looking forward, Helen, to you and I going to see it.
Absolutely.
And telling James all about it afterwards. No, you can come, Jimbo.
Thank you.
I'll get 3 tickets.
Oh, what?
Oh, God. Ben, I'll get 4 tickets.
Yay.
Okay. 4 tickets. We group outing. Let's go.
4 for the Popinjay Cavalier, please.
Yes. Unfortunately, I can only afford the cheap seats right at the top, the God seats. But still, we'll be able to make out vaguely what's going on stage. Anything else? Anything actual movie news?
Yeah, there is some.
Okay.
Kate Winslet is apparently, they reckon now pretty firmly, the female lead, whatever that is, in The Hunt for Gollum.
Who, using your vast Tolkienite lore knowledge...
There is no lore for this.
Who
this
do
is
you
some
think
bullshit.
She's going to be?
Lady Gollum.
Do we think an elf?
A Gollum with a little pink bow and the wispy hairs.
Yes.
Looking at her face, my inclination is elf. However, I have no reason to think that, and it wouldn't make maybe a huge amount of sense. So I don't know, like woman out in the wilds doing stuff. I just think it's probably part of that, you know, desperate attempt to, you know, add some female characters occasionally to J.R.R. Tolkien's stories. Because, you know, look, his only experience really of action in his life and most of his working life had, of course, been surrounded entirely by men. Like, he loved his wife very much. He was he was wildly romantic about her. That's where you get all that love poetry and everything from, and all the sort of mad star-crossed lovers
in
the stories.
All the Tom Bombadil love poetry.
Yeah, well, actually, genuinely, yes, because Tom Bombadil is a wife guy. He's a big wife guy,
Middle
Tom
Earth's
Bombadil.
Biggest wife guy.
He's quite small physically, but yes. And, you know, they tried, I mean, for Lord of the Rings, you know, if people read the magazine recently, you know, Liv Tyler was talking about it, about the fact that they really tried to get Arwen more of an action role, and it just didn't work. They just couldn't make it feel like Lord of the Rings and also have her at Helm's Deep. But they literally, she shot scenes in that battle. She was there on set. She was doing it. So this could be a new character, and it almost certainly is a new character. unless she's going to take over Galadriel or something, or AN other Rivendell.
I don't think she'll be doing that.
I don't think so.
I can't imagine they'd recast
Cate Blanchett
that way.
Still looks exactly the same, let's be honest.
Yes, yes, very
I'm
much
confused
so.
About this film, though, because I was asking John Nugent, who is a big Rings head in the office. I was like, so I thought this film takes place within the time scale of Fellowship of the Ring, of that little squidge of time when Gandalf hotfoots it to a big library, ruffles through a bunch of papers to try and figure out what happened to the ring. And
yes, but...
Yeah, John was like, oh yeah, well that's like 20 years.
And 17,
I said, I'm sorry. Mm. It looked like a weekend in the Peter Jackson film.
They squished it in the Peter Jackson film.
It turns out it's a big squidge of time and not a tiny squidge of time.
So basically, the birthday party at the start of Lord of the Rings is Bilbo's 71st, but also Frodo's 33rd. And then Gandalf basically goes away until Frodo turns 50, which is kind of like going from, in Hobbit terms, going from like 18 to like, I don't know, 25 or 28. Or
they're like dog
right?
years.
Kind they live longer than us, so kind of yes. So they don't, their equivalent of like becoming an adult is 33. Which is, you can probably get some like Christian metaphors there.
What?
Anyway, yeah, and then like at 50, they're kind of like a proper grown, like fully formed adult. So that's Frodo's age when he goes on the adventure, which is about Bilbo's age in The Hobbit.
I still think in human years, if my mate was like, I'll be right back, and then came back in 7 years, I'd be like, where the hell have you been?
17. But at the same time, he doesn't
say... But in human
years,
you said it's about like seven-ish.
But he doesn't say, I'll be right back. He just says, oh, look after it and keep it secret, keep it safe. Mm. Like, that's a line. So, but then he spends a lot of time researching and trying to reconstruct that narrative and also find Gollum. So there is a chunk of time there. Peter Jackson has made a rod for his own back by suggesting that, yes, it's essentially a week or two, but it is longer than that.
Also, I feel like Gandalf doesn't find Gollum. Gollum gets captured by
and
the
tortured.
Baddies. And, Shia! I'm so confused about planning. This. But it's almost like they're really trying to make the hunt for Gollum happen.
They are. It's happening.
It's happening.
Yeah.
There's nothing we can do to stop it.
Should it be happening?
I mean, it's so true of so many things nowadays. Like, do we need another one of these, or should we do something else?
You're talking about this podcast, right?
Pretty much, yes.
Oh, for God's sake. But, you know, every day is Christmas Eve.
Every
day is Christmas Eve, Ben. I think it could be good. It could be good. Let's give it the benefit of the doubt.
100%. Oh, absolutely, it could be.
Yeah, Kate Winslet doesn't sign up for shit.
Absolutely.
What else has been happening? Oh, this is exciting news.
Mm-hmm.
James, you must be excited about this.
This is the King Conan news, isn't it?
King Conan.
Yes. Arnold spoke, as he has a tendency to do sometimes, and basically just dropped a number of truth bombs, one of which was that he's going to be doing King Conan with Chris McQuarrie. And the other thing is that he's been working with Dan Trachtenberg on a new Predator, and that he's got a script for Commando 2. And you're like, I'm sorry, what? Part of me thinks he's had a dream. Like, I'm not 100% convinced any of these things are real, but, and I'm not 100% sure I want some, like, nobody needs Arnold at the 80 years doing Commando 2, let's be honest. But King Conan, I think, is something that could work.
That could be interesting.
As he wears his crown upon a troubled brow.
It could be quite Cohen the Barbarian as well. If you know the Terry Pratchett character of Cohen, I would be quite up for seeing that, which is basically a bunch of really old barbarians who decide to go and, like, conquer a kingdom, and they just do because they're the ones who survived, so they're real good at fighting despite all having various ailments. I think that would be quite a funny, you know, angle for him to play, but I'm sure that's not the focus of
always
King
be Kong. Wary of an old man in a young man's profession.
This is interesting. I don't know how official this is. I'll be honest with you. I didn't realize that this came from Arnold running his mouth off.
He had a chat with someone and just went, oh, by the way, I'm going to be doing this. And you're like, all right, brilliant. Thanks, Arnie.
I thought this was announced to the trades as Chris McQuarrie's next movie. And he was making it with Arnold Schwarzenegger. But I didn't realize that, no.
There's a very real chance this is news to Chris McQuarrie.
Well, hey, why not? If you can, you know, send it out into the universe and the universe might manifest it. You never know.
Let's hope.
I feel like a lot of Hollywood is obsessed with Conan, the idea of Conan, though. It's come up in various interviews I've done. People bring up, is it the Frazetti? Is that the name of the artist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Frazetta, yeah.
Like, iconic Conan artwork. It's come up in Star Wars interviews I've done. I'm sure it's come up in a few other bits as well, where they always reference that as like a sort of core totem to work towards, that there's something like really, well, yeah, mythological,
taut muscles and loincloths.
Yeah.
Mm. But also the stance and the power of those characters and the sort of mythological status that they hold for Hollywood storytellers. So maybe I think there's a whole bunch of people out there in LA who would love to do something Conan-wise.
It could be cool.
It could be cool. I don't know that it's going to happen. I really don't, but who knows? Who knows? Maybe he'll start filming next week.
He may yet crush his enemies, see them driven before him.
And hear the lamentations of the women.
Indeed.
Yes.
Billie Eilish might be starring in The Bell Jar for Sarah Polley.
What?
Sarah Polley directing The Bell Jar. Yeah, that makes 100% sense to me. She's the, you know, director of Women Talking. Her tackling the Sylvia Plath novel makes a certain amount of sense. It's a difficult one to put on screen. A bunch of people have tried because everybody loves this book, but it is effectively a story about being really depressed. So it's hard to kind of give it a really...
Comedy then.
Yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, Billie Eilish can maybe bring some soulful music to it at least. I don't know.
I'm really intrigued if we get an episode of The Studio that is about Sarah Polley trying to make a film of The Bell Jar with Billie Eilish and Seth Rogen.
It does feel like one, doesn't it?
Yeah. An interesting pivot for Billie Eilish, though. Obviously, she's been around movies. She's done the Big Bond song and Barbie song. I have not known her as somebody who's tended to like dabble in acting. Mm. And so I think she's done like an episode of a TV show.
Yeah.
And that's about it. She's incredibly talented, a genuinely an unknown quantity as a star. And this is like a big, if she's the lead of a film, Sarah Polley, very respected director, there's got to be something there.
Yeah.
It's interesting as a big pivot for her.
It's a pretty interesting sort of track record for pop stars turning actor recently. I mean, I honestly think the Jonas Christmas movie was good, right? So like, but leaving that aside, even just talking about the female superstars, Lady Gaga, good actor. Okay. Beyonce has done good work, you know.
I mean, the big year for this year is Charlie XCX. A bunch of acting stuff.
But also, like, she in her own, you know, faux documentary film is bloody fantastic. I thought she was absolutely great in that. So if Billie Eilish can, you know, keep up that standard, we're in for a real treat.
And we're about to get a Billie Eilish movie because we've got the James Cameron 3D Billie Eilish concert movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe James Cameron comes in and does a 3D conversion on The Bell Jar.
I swear to God, someone must have said, how can we get James Dyer to go to a Billie Eilish concert movie? And they're all, let's get James Cameron to direct it. And that's why I'm on board.
Yeah. As a Swiftie, how do you feel about Billie Eilish? Is it like a natural predator of Taylor Swift?
No,
or
I do not believe there is bad blood there particularly. So I think we're good.
They coexist within the same ecosystem.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Bad blood was with someone else.
Yeah, that was with someone else. But no, I quite like Billie Eilish.
All right, good stuff. All right, well, something exciting happened while we were talking about movie news. Movie news dropped for once. Hollywood didn't wait for us to have finished recording the podcast before dropping some stuff. They dropped a second trailer for Steven Spielberg's Disclosure Day. We took a little break to watch it. And what did we make of it? What does it look like it's about? Bit more clarity now, I would say, than the first teaser.
Fractionally more, yes. But the idea, it's basically, it's still going into a little bit of creepiness. It's still leaning into a little bit of what is going on exactly, but giving us a bit more understanding of, okay, the government or the governments have been covering up the existence of aliens since, it sounds like, Roswell. Coleman Domingo references 79 years, so putting it in the near future, I guess, but Roswell sort of a thing. And saying that basically Josh O'Connor seems to be trying to bring it all to light with the question mark help of Emily Blunt, who seems to be unaware of what's going on, but seems to be definitely involved in it. And Colin Firth is definitely trying to cover it up.
Yeah.
That I'm clear on.
It's exciting. I just Spielberg doing science fiction. It's been, 21 years since War of the Worlds?
Mm.
And I am incredibly psyched about this.
You have obviously forgotten Ready Player One, but that's okay. Let's just continue.
No, 21 years. I'm saying 21 years since this last
As the Ready Player One defender,
no,
I will
no,
say
Ben,
it's becoming
on.
Increasingly real. What is Fortnite if not the Oasis?
still does make it good.
Look, look, this is exciting. And I think as far as atonement for West Side Story goes, this is coming a long way. So, you know.
Boo on you.
Well, that's the 11th thing I know
about
James.
It's so pretty.
There's some real, like, classic sci-fi Spielberg stuff here of the proximity of awe and terror. The, like, the magnitude of the alien shit happening here looks both kind of thrilling but also very unsettling in a kind of Close Encounters way rather than a friendly ET kind of way. And some of the, because the imagery looks quite quite cold and quite stark, there's a bit of AI about this as well, and I am a big AI the movie fan.
AI the thing. Yeah.
Thumbs down from me personally.
I have long been an AI defender. The movie, not the thing. Wow. For me, the tone of this seems like really balanced halfway between Close Encounters and War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting. That's an exciting place to be.
It's like it's a proper, the sort of weather sequence where she starts speaking the alien tongue. Mm. That's a proper kind of hairs on the back of your neck. I'm assuming you can already do a degree in that language at some university in America, but I love it. I think it's brilliant because it's really creepy. It's really unnerving. It's very disturbing. There's something almost atavistic about it. It's horrifying.
Mm.
I think it's interesting as well. There seems to be an emphasis on this with the Josh O'Connor character of wanting to reveal this information of the need for truth. And if we're talking about AI, the thing, not the movie, we are in a time when it's going to become increasingly difficult to know what is true and what is not in terms of what we're seeing and what is known. And we already have been through years away from AI of just manipulation of truth and fake news in quotations and twisting of the truth. And so I think it's an interesting time for a big sci-fi movie that is doing alien shenanigans that at the same time seems to be about the need for truth.
Fun fact, by the way, Ben didn't say any of that. That was all AI. Secondly, there's a bit in this where Colin Firth appears, because he seems to be a baddie, and this appears to Eve Hewson, a.k.a. Flora from Flora and Son. She's in this as well, and he appears to her in her kitchen, but apparently by some sort of hologram or something
like that.
I mean, he controls her in some way.
I don't think it's a hologram. It feels like it's some kind of like mental sort of psychic projection thing with the aid of technology. Like it seems to be she's receiving it somehow.
Do you think this is going to be like the gesture control in
Minority Report,
which was total science fiction at the time and then became the basis of how we interact with screens these days. And in 20 years, we're all going to have neural implants that mean we too, if we choose to, can see Colin Firth in our kitchens.
I don't want Chris beamed into my kitchen on a whim. That's just too upsetting.
Oh, I might be in your kitchen this weekend.
Oh, no. But you'll be literally in my kitchen this weekend.
Yeah, this is true. Mm. Anyway, looks good. The movie will be out later on in the year. Pick a month. June, July?
One of those.
Feels like it's a summer movie. There's a big action sequence with a car and a train.
Two trains.
Cars.
What's better than one train? Two trains. What's better than one car? Two cars. Fantastic. All right. That's the disclosure.
Maths with Chris Hewitt.
Yes.
I mean, I guess it depends on your definition of better. Anyway.
Yes. But there you go. Disclosure day. Trailer hath dropped. Shall we have a guest?
Let's
do it. We only have one guest this week. Overall, usually we have a spin-off show, The Interviews, if I've overbooked. but that is not the case. This week, we only have one guest. Next week, not the case. This week, one guest, and that guest is Tim Roth, and he is one of the stars of Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man, which is the continuation, the big screen continuation / small screen, if you're watching it on Netflix, of Peaky Blinders, the very, very successful BBC show, starring, of course, Cillian Murphy as Tommy Shelby. James?
Tommy Shelby.
There you go. Thanks,
no
James.
Fighting. No fucking fighting.
It's good. It's better than mine. It is better than mine. So Tim Roth is in this. It's set in World War II, and Tim Roth is a rotter. He is a rotter in this, and he is having all sorts of fun. He plays a guy called Beckett, who is an English guy, but he is a Nazi agent who is working against the Shelbys, and in fact, the King and the Crown.
Boo.
And we will not stand for that kind of thing. We will not stand for that. He has, if you've seen the movie, it's been out in cinemas for about a week or so. It's going to be on Netflix next week. If you've seen the movie, he has an incredible opening line, which we talk about, but we don't actually say the line for obvious reasons in this interview. Had a lot of fun talking to Tim Roth. Do please enjoy it.
This character is a hell of a character. The movie will be out in cinemas by the time this is going out.
Okay.
So some people will have seen it.
Okay.
You have an amazing character introduction in this film.
I didn't see it because I was in the loo having a piss with Steve Knight. So
do you schedule your piss breaks?
I never watch anything that I'm in.
Right.
I very rarely do. I have a couple of exceptions, but Killian and Tom, director, threatened me. So I was like, all right, I've got to watch it. So I thought, I'll watch it. And my wife was really pleased that I was going to sit in and do that. So I did it. But I missed the beginning.
Okay.
And I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And that was a line that I improvised when we were shooting the train stuff. It wasn't in the script.
Really?
Yeah. And we were mucking about, me and Tom, it was just me getting on and off a train. I was so happy. I was like a child around the steam trains in Didcot. It was so lovely. And they were doing an incredible job. There was none of the shaky camera acting stuff that was going on. They were really just doing
classical stuff.
They wanted to make it like an old period movie and filmed in that time, in a sense. And so we were having a fantastic time doing all the station work. And then I just threw that line back at, it was actually aimed at Tom.
Should we say what the line is for people who maybe?
And
let's
let him find it. And then I, of course, that was actually, I could not believe they kept that as the first line of the film.
It's the first line of the film.
It sums it up.
It's a mission statement. It's a statement of intent for the whole thing.
So I missed it because of Steve. I think he did it intentionally because he hadn't written that line.
He's furious.
He's absolutely furious.
You should get co-writing credit on this.
He's from Birmingham. What are you going to do?
But it is. It's such an amazing way. I'm so glad it's improvised. That is hilarious.
Yeah. And Tom's laughing his ass off. And he said, do it again. I was all right. And then so every time we were doing ADR and stuff, you know, transatlantic, I said, he brought it up. He said, you know, that's the first line in the movie. And I thought they cut it. I really did. I didn't think it would survive, but they kept it in.
So you don't watch your own movies?
No.
At all?
No.
Is that something you've had since day one?
No, not at all. I stopped doing it, I don't know how many years ago, long time ago. The exceptions were, if it's a Quentin thing, I like to see what he's up to. I'd love to see what the actors are up to too, and cinematically. And then there's this Mexican filmmaker that I work with, Michel Franco, and he's always doing something intriguing cinematically. So I watched those two, and that's it. And then I broke my law for this one.
Because it
came about really because, you know, when you're doing a crap movie, sometimes you have to do a crap movie, and it's fair play, and sometimes they're the most fun to do.
Yeah.
Just to make sure no student loans, keep the roof on, do that stuff. So you got to do them.
Yep.
And but then you do the ones that they in a way pay for, which are the ones for love. You do all that stuff. But there were a couple of films that I did which were where the ego of the director and the power of the money behind the film, it felt like they got in the way of the actual of what the film could have been, having been on set, you know, and it being an extraordinary experience and fantastic script and all of that. And then outside sort of forces can just corrupt that. So I stopped watching.
So you watched those films and then you were disappointed
I don't need to do this anymore.
Yeah.
I'll stop because the experience of making it is what's important to me in that respect. Those days on set with those actors, I don't want that to be broken.
So obviously your experience of making films is very, very different to people's experience when they watch the films. But does that mean then, because you haven't watched these movies, years later when someone comes up to you and maybe quotes a line from something you haven't seen?
Yeah, it's nice.
Does it ring a bell for you, or do you?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you keep those experiences in here
I find it interesting. So the things that people like and they come up and want to talk about. I like that it's so varied, you know.
Yeah.
And quite often they come up and they tell me about a film I haven't seen, which again is really fun. I like that.
That's amazing. So I was thinking about some of your character introductions over the years, and obviously you kick off Pulp Fiction as well, which is which is nice.
Yeah, we're beginning and end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beginning and end. Yeah.
Yeah. We had a lot of fun making that.
I can imagine that you did.
Yeah, we did. And he shot it as almost a separate film.
So yeah, we shot in that location,
shot
right?
Those in, that was the beginning of the shooting schedule, and he just did the pumpkin honey bunny scenes.
Yeah.
I think we shot them over 2 weeks or something like that. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's amazing because you get that you get to be on the end of the Ringo speech as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. With Mandy P. I love Mandy P. She's amazing. Yeah.
Is that your nickname for her?
I did this thing. I used to do this thing where I was over here when I was first starting acting, where I would go to like theatre design colleges like Central and stuff and just put my name up on the board saying actor available. You know, because they would want to do plays so they could do that if they were in costume design or anything like that. So I ended up going to the Edinburgh Festival and stuff like that, doing plays up there. That's how I did it. So when I got to America, I would make sure that and I already had 10 years on me at that point, but I made sure that students knew that they could approach me. And so I would do student films. And I met Amanda I'd met her in London sort of briefly when I was doing a play, but I met her over there. We did a student film together.
Wow.
That's okay. And then I introduced her to Quentin.
The rest is history.
Yeah.
So is that something you still do? Are you still approachable in that way?
I'm going off to do independent film next with Timmy Spall.
Uh-huh. Wow.
One of my heroes.
The old Mike Lee Venn diagram full effect there again.
We've done a couple of moody films together, but we had so much fun.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I was doing, Little Indie in Wales, and he happened to be there. So I said, do you want to do this thing? So, yeah, so off we go.
So if someone wants to cast Tim Roth in a student film, how do they go about doing that?
Make the call. It is out there that I am approachable about that stuff.
Yeah.
Independent film especially is important to me.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. It's in your bones. So
I feel the fragility of it as well. I mean, I love working with first-time film directors, and I've got a good record for that, Quentin being one of them.
Yeah.
And so, it's always that's first time out is not an off-put to me at all.
Amazing. So how did you get approached to be in this? Was it a clandestine?
One,
yeah, clandestine meeting?
I texted Killian, who I worked with before, again on a little film. And then we've met over the years. Mm-hmm. And we get on well, me and him. So I texted him after he won his Oscar and I said, keep your head down and get running, you know. And we were laughing. And then he texted me back and said, want to do a film? I was like, yeah. And then this came up. Yeah. So that was it.
That simple.
And he got, he gave Rebecca the job and Barry too on this.
Wow.
He wanted to put those people around for this particular sort of world, part of that, of the Peaky world, I suppose. We were very lucky. It was fun.
Were you a Peaky fan? Peaky flan? A flan? A fan?
A flan.
A flan.
I was more of a flan. No, I'd not seen it.
Okay.
I bumped into him over the years when he was filming it, which is fun. I knew some of the actors that went through it, and they're always good. Benjamin Zeff and I worked with at the very beginnings, and I was just a fan of his anyway.
Yeah.
People like Stephen Graham and, you know, just get good mob in.
Mm.
And so... it'd always been one of those things that was sitting there. And then when Killian asked me to do it, I had to make a decision on whether I was going to watch it or not.
Okay.
And I decided not to. So I just came into it brand new, and which I thought the was right for the character. He's walking into that world, and he doesn't know him.
He doesn't know these people.
Yeah.
He hasn't seen Peaky Blinders.
No, he hasn't. He hasn't. And also, they have the questionable on the kind of fashion front too. So I did that, and now I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch it after this is all over, yeah.
Because you come in, Beckett's a great disruptor.
He's a good guy. Yeah, he's a peacekeeper, and he wants to try he's trying to stop a war, and he's just asking for some help.
It's a very flexible reading of your character's actions here, Tim.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, is this one of those classic actors who are playing the bad guy? The character doesn't want to be the bad guy.
No, he's a good guy.
That opening line would beg to differ, but yeah. Okay.
when they sent me the scripts, so I was really looking forward to it because Stephen Knight, you know.
Yeah.
He was not written that way. He was written aristocratic, kind of upper classy, militaristic, you know, very formal and all of that. And I hadn't met them. So I did the Zoom thing with Tom, director, and Stephen. And I said, quick question, what about if? And my take on it was, could we make him more like a working class kind of geography teacher?
Yeah.
And so, you know, he's got a job to do. He's quite pragmatic. And but he is less alien to the Peakies than that would have been. So there's a level where he can communicate. He can meet with them. He can be in the same room. And that it's not that class system at play, but as much. And so, they were up for it completely. And we just flipped and went down that road.
I was really struck by him. I thought he was a really compelling character, despite his affiliations. He's the smartest guy in the room, I think, at all times in this movie.
Yeah.
And there's a real joy to be taken as a viewer watching someone like yourself play the smartest guy in the room.
Because
you have a smile playing on your lips, I think, throughout.
Well, there's that, but that would depend on what the other actors were up to.
Yeah.
And it was we had a lot of room for maneuver. Tom was very good with that. And we would just play out the scene, see where they went. And then gradually they would hone themselves and find. But yeah, he's... yeah, I'm sitting having a chat, trying to get the job done. You know,
and most of your scenes are with Barry
and with Baz.
Yeah,
which was great. And again, he likes to play.
Yeah,
and so we would find our way, and then I kind of watch him and see where he's going with stuff. And it's just a very amenable character to play, as in he can go in any direction. You got to watch him. You got to watch your back, really. Well, actually, your front. Yeah.
But again, you're the smartest guy in the room, so you think you can handle him. No spoilers. We could get into spoilers, but we won't get into spoilers.
No, it's fun to play, for sure.
Yeah. But with Killian,
he felt like he belonged in that world. That's for sure.
Yeah, very much so.
On one level or another.
With Killian, though, I don't think it's saying a huge spoiler to say you don't have a lot of scenes with him. Despite the fact he texted you and said, you want to do a film together, and then you're barely in it with him.
No, we have moments.
You have moments, yes.
That's key.
Yeah.
No, the idea is always with those, you have to give them a really good mountain to climb over.
Yeah.
And that was what I was there for, I think, you know. And so when we do have our scenes together, they are fun.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. You get to shoot at each other in this sort of classic 1920s gangster style. There's an action scene involving horses and Tommy guns and all sorts of stuff.
Those horses are extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the machine guns were going off.
Yeah.
And the horses were better trained than the actors. Let me just say that. That was extraordinary. Beautiful too.
Hurling and dialogue at each other through.
Doing it across the backs with the others. But it was very... again, it felt like an old movie in a way. It felt like an old, like, 30s movie of its time, you know. It was kind of nice to be a part of that. Yeah.
But then there's always this lovely punk aesthetic as well to the film. It feels very, very classical.
Yeah.
You know, it's a World War II movie that has obviously the Peaky Blinders aesthetic applied to it as well. So you get
it gives a nod to the show. I mean, it's part of the show from what I hear. And they really wanted to do that. It's a cinema version or episode of a long running show, and I think that's a good thing to do. So its consistency is there, and the characters are there, even the new ones. They feel they should be in that world, you know.
So you haven't seen Peaky Blinders, but what shows do you watch?
I don't really watch. To be honest with you, I'm more a sort of movie buff guy. I'll tell you what I have been watching, which has been really helpful. Is we had a difficult time with our family. We had some illness in the family and stuff. I'm going through a really, really difficult time. Mm. And I remember coming down in the kitchen I don't know if this is what you want in your interview, but I come down the kitchen and my wife had found that television show, Would I Lie to You?
Oh my God.
Right? And you got Lee Mack and David Mitchell doing their thing. And I was like, what is this?
Sharpest guys.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And then we started sort of watching this and it would just give us a break from everything. And there was James Acaster on it and, you know, all of these different comedians. And then we started looking at the comedians that are around in Britain, which I think is some of the best in the world, if not the best in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, Greg Davies and Taskmaster stuff, and you find them again. And then Ramesh and I'm going on a TV thing about this with Sarah Pascoe.
Oh, really?
She's phenomenal. And then Luz Sanders. And I mean, just honestly, it keeps going.
So we
went on a comedy binge.
Oh, man.
And I love that. And that gives you a break.
Yeah.
In absolutely the best way, I think.
Half hour, 45 minutes.
I'll take a bit of that. I need a bit of that, especially now with everything that's happening in the world. You can really use them.
Yeah.
They're brilliant, I think.
I love those shows. By the way, I mean, I know... on Would I Lie to You. Mm. Over the years, they do tend to have actors on. Samantha Morton's been on. Tom Courtney's been on.
I don't know if I'd survive.
You'd survive.
I'd like to have a go, though, for sure. So I could take on Lee Mack.
Or be in his team, and then you wouldn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, I'd be fine. He is so sharp. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Not Going Out is his show.
Yes, that's
it's
right.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, incredible. They're so quick. It's so quick.
I'm going to campaign, Tim. I want you to be on that.
Yeah. We're actually doing a whole campaign just to get as much as possible to sort of just get over here and make films and work over here. And then just across Europe. So good. So interesting.
Absolutely.
Good stuff coming.
Tim Roth, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, man.
Cheers, pal.
Thanks
a lot.
Okay, that was Tim Roth talking about Peaky Blinders. Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man, which is out in cinemas right now, I think for another week or so, and then it'll hit in Netflix.
Yes.
And then we'll be doing a spoiler special about it, Jimbo.
Yes, I've now seen it.
Very excited about because I haven't seen a single second of Peaky Blinders. And this could be fun. This could be a good one.
Yeah.
It could be a good one. But what an opening line. My God. talk about a statement of intent and then moving on from there. But let's talk about movies that are out this week in the multiplexes or indeed on your sofaplexes. It is the reviews section of the show. Actually, let's start with a movie that was out on Netflix last week, but we didn't get round to it in the reviews section. And this is Jack Reacher starring as Alan Ritchson in War Machine.
Yes.
Jimbo.
Hello. This is the second War Machine film on Netflix.
It is.
Yes, indeed, because David Michaud's film, was it 2017 with Brad Pitt, the satire, the anti-war satire?
Probably. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is significantly more fun than that.
Are you saying War Machine rocks with an X?
Do you know what? I wished if this film had been 4 stars when I wrote the review, that was the verdict that I had pre-packaged for it. Yeah. Unfortunately, spoiler, I gave it 3 stars.
Yeah,
so
fair.
It doesn't rock, but it kind of wobbles.
James came out of retirement to write the review of War Machine for the magazine. And I have to say, James, it was very good.
Thank you very much. I was tricked. Do you remember we were in the office, we were talking to John. We're like, John, have you got someone at War Machine? You should really review War Machine. And John said to me, thank you, 600 words. I was like, fuck!
Mind games.
Yeah, that's
mind
right.
Mind games from
I was
John
tricked.
Lucas.
I was tricked into writing this review. Anyway, this does star Jack Reacher as 81, for he is numerically named. That is the name he is given when he joins the Army Rangers, the sort of like training program to join the elite recon division of the Army Rangers. So we get a prologue where he and his bro, Jai Courtney, who for whatever reason doesn't make it out of the prologue.
I knew that because Jai Courtney is my specialist subject.
Yes, that's right. And I'm like, Chris, how long does Jai Courtney last in War Machine in minutes? Go on. Tell me immediately.
2.5.
Roughly accurate, yes.
It must be the easiest payday he's ever
yeah,
had.
Turn up, get blown up, leave.
I'm going to cash out bloody chick, mate. That's what
I
he
felt
says.
That was a spoiler, but all right.
It's the prologue.
Is it a spoiler? I don't know. I mean, he practically has Dead Meat Thompson written on his face.
He does.
He gets blown up. Jack Reacher carries him like 300 miles on his back, but he still dies. And Jack Reacher...
Because he's only got the top half.
That's... Jesus. Jack Reacher, as a tribute to his dear departed Jai Courtney, decides to join the Army Ranger because that's something they'd always planned to do together. So it was like a big bro bonding thing.
Yeah.
But of course, he's very, very surly and PTSD'd and he's sad about his dead brother. He punches people and he runs a lot with a backpack on and he's like the ultimate soldier, but he has a gammy knee. So you're actually wondering if he will become an Army Ranger. So it's like a boot camp movie. And then about halfway through, they are told that they have the final challenge in their trial to become Army Rangers. And it's called the Death March, which obviously doesn't bode well. And the idea is that they go out in the field and they have to find a fake thing. They have to find a MacGuffin and take a picture of it and then blow it up, whatever it is. They go out there and what they actually stumble across is basically an alien killing machine, which has just landed. Because all the way through the film, we're hearing about, oh, there's an asteroid coming. It's like, oh, I wonder if this asteroid could be important. Anyway, alien lands, they wake up the alien follows them. And this enables the writer-director of this film, who is in fact Patrick Hughes, who did both Hitman's Wife's Bodyguards Dogs films.
Yes, Hitman's Wife's
and
Dentist
Expendables
Bodyguard.
Expendables 3,
I'm going to say it, the only good Expendables movie.
Expend3bles. Right. Yeah. So he did those. And he basically sat down one day in front of the word processor and thought, what if Predator but Transformers? And that's basically what this film is. They are hunted through jungles, quarries, rivers, you name it, the Great American Wilderness, by
schools.
A giant steroidal ED-209 type alien killing machine.
Yes.
Which, for whatever reason, thinks that the best way to invade Earth is by randomly hunting student soldiers. Fine, whatever.
Well, I think, to be fair, the aliens have landed, like, all over, and this one is just targeting the only people who are
around. It feels a bit low stakes that there have got to be more important people to kill than these guys. Anyway, it sort of goes around, follows around, killing them all, until eventually it comes up against Jack Reacher. And I will not spoil... What happens next?
Oh my God. R.A.P. Jack Reacher.
Jack Reacher is horribly eviscerated by a Transformer.
The top half of Jack Reacher forms with the bottom half of Jai Courtney. And they come together as some sort of massive Voltron of
Jai
muscles.
Creature.
Yeah. Jai Creature.
Yeah, that's what happens. Basically, that's what happens. This is so fucking stupid. Like, it is stupid with a capital S. It is the most stupid thing ever devised, and I had a really good time watching it. What have we seen? What was the other film last week that we saw that was really boring?
I mean, I don't...
That doesn't really narrow it down, does it? Anyway, we saw something last week. I can't remember what it was. It was very boring. And so when I came to see this, this was like a glass of cool water in the desert. Like, it was exactly what I needed. Brainless, utterly stupid, deeply ridiculous fun. And I had a whale of a time with it. It's quite repetitive, if I'm honest. Like, really, like, a lot of the action sequences are quite rote, but it's still enjoyable. And even though I don't know what the budget for this film is, but the CGI is very, very convincing. I actually really enjoyed the big, you know, monster on soldier action.
And they shot on location as well.
And they shoot on location.
You feel that.
There's an LED volume in sight, which is lovely.
Yeah.
It's not Predator, obviously, but it's still a good time. And also, bearing in mind this is a straight-to-Netflix movie, I feel like this is the absolute definition of, oh, I've got nothing to do on Friday night. Let's turn on Netflix. I wonder what War Machine is. Should I spend 2 hours watching it? And the answer is, fuck yes!
That was my main issue, is that it felt so Netflix.
It does.
And it has that like grey digital sheen to
it. Written and directed by Netflix.
Yes, basically. The algorithm. Alan G. Rhythm is the producer on this one.
Yes.
So when you think of Predator, it's not just that the characters pop and the alien is incredible.
Mm.
It's got that sense of like texture and the sweat, and you feel that in the celluloid of that film. Whereas this is so cold, digital sheen, Netflix to the max. And actually, I think with the film itself, it's actually a bit better than that and is slightly underserved by being compressed and greyed out for a Netflix release. And I thought it got more and more fun and exciting as it went along. They do a really good job of making it convincing that this giant alien robot is going to absolutely eviscerate you. There's quite a lot of like gooey gore in this because people get exploded into bits by the war machine. And so you do feel that panic. They have like nice little devices of, oh, when his compass starts going nuts, that means the war machine's nearby and imminently the shit is going to hit the fan. And when those things happen, you feel that kind of spike of, oh, you've really got to hightail it out of there. There were a few points where I got annoyed with the Rangers, who they'd all stop
like
to see the war machine is coming, and they'd sort of stand there for 5 seconds going, oh no, the war machine's coming. You're like, no, you like should have started running like 5 seconds
and then they
ago. And then they die because they get exploded into bits.
I did think there's a bit of a tension in this film between, on one hand, you know, his personal journey involves, you know, getting past his own trauma to become a leader, to accept the help and companionship and support of others. And also, they really kind of want him to be the last man standing and do it all on his own. And they couldn't quite, for me, balance those two in a way that felt really sort of narratively character satisfying. I know I'm maybe silly asking for character work in this film, but, you know, it would have been nice.
We know
he can do it.
Honestly, I think that's film's one of its biggest problems is the lack of characterization. And it's not just because he is, as I said in my review, basically Jack Reacher with a gammy knee. Like, there's no real distinction between these two characters. But also, I think, you know, Aliens and Predator are two films that show you that it is possible to have completely rounded characters within a squadron of troops. You don't have to spend a lot of time with them to make them feel distinct, and they're all a bit homogenous here. It's just, you're just cannon fodder.
They're like, just, they don't they're really just some do guys.
Much. I think Stephen James is probably the only one that that stands out, but I would have liked to have known the soldiers before they got splatted.
That's a big thing for me. I also, the ending is sequel baity.
Yeah.
To the max.
Yeah, it really is.
I didn't need that.
We don't need more War Machine. Yeah. But
when Jai Courtney comes back.
Yeah, that's right.
He's putting a team together.
Yeah. I should say in the Jai Courtney thing that was just an elaborate joke, by the way, because some people, you know, will go, oh, it's just the first 2.5 minutes of the movie. And we're going, it's not a spoiler, but it absolutely is a spoiler. Except it's not, because Jai Courtney doesn't die in the first 2.5 minutes of the movie. It was just a joke. And and he is very alive throughout the rest of the movie, but just off screen where you can't see him.
He goes off to live on a farm.
He does. Yeah. Where he's happy for the rest
Upstate.
Of his days. But yes, because I know some people do get annoyed about things like that. And honestly, if it was something that happened at the 30-minute mark, I don't think it's fair game, but I think 2.5 minutes into a movie like this, where he is fairly heavily telegraphed as dead meat, I think it's okay to say that. But if you feel otherwise, then I'm sorry that Ben annoyed you.
What? I said nothing. Like Reacher.
Like Reacher. Ben said nothing.
I like that they've made this, though, and not just tried to remake Predator, but in that realm of like, let's remix and reinvigorate these types of films rather than just remaking them. I think it's a step below like Upgrade and The Guest, which I think are the upper tier of let's channel that like 80s
but yeah
vibe.
In the same way, this is like bottom shelf of blockbuster fodder, like, but in the best possible way. It's the kind of stuff that you would rent when like something like Poltergeist 2 was already rented and you, oh, I'll get this instead.
When Poltergeist 2 was already rented.
It's possible that I'm mining my I'm mining my own experience there, because that literally happened to me.
Why didn't
I turned
they call
up,
it Poltergeist?
Poltergeist. I went to rent it out. Unfortunately, somebody had moved it. You know, didn't know who. But it,
like, is this a Poltergeist joke?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was.
3 stars for War Machine. 1 star if you're a Jai Courtney fan. Right. Hell's Bells.
Hello.
Stifling a yawn. Please, just long enough to tell us about, this is a film whose title I forget, even though I've literally just written it down, Reminders of Him, Paige and Alanis Morissette.
Of Him.
Some serious irony going on there. Reminders of Him.
Yes. So this is an adaptation of a Colleen Hoover novel, the woman who wrote It Ends With Us. Came out with Blake Lively, Justin Baldoni, a million lawsuits.
I've never heard of it, Helen. Was it in any way controversial or reported upon?
It's fine. But yeah, this is the latest adaptation of her work. And it stars Micah Monroe as a woman who comes back to town after a while away. We learn pretty swiftly that she was in prison. It takes us a little bit longer to realize why she was there. And she's trying to reestablish contact with her daughter, who she has basically never met. She was taken away as soon as she gave birth. And she has been raised by her paternal grandparents, who are played by Lauren Graham and Bradley Whitford.
Oh, you like Lauren Graham?
I do, and I like Bradley Whitford, Lemon Lyman from West
yes.
So this is all great, but she gets back to town, and wouldn't you know it, there's a local hottie played by, interestingly, the star of Him. It really is Reminders of Him. It's Tyreke Withers.
Him. Oh, yeah. Him from Him in Reminders of Him.
Him from Him in Reminders of Him, yeah.
Hey Siri, set reminder.
Anyway, he has a role in the life of her child. He's basically a surrogate dad slash uncle in the life. He's basically the dead father's best friend. The father has died. You don't really realize for a little while exactly how. Sure, yes. And they totally fancy each other immediately because they're the best looking people in the film of appropriate age. And so
I hope that's a line.
Hey, we're the best looking people around. Want to get together?
Of appropriate age.
And then it's like, no, we cannot because circumstances divide us. Oh, no. So it's basically them sort of, you know, trying to work things out. Look, this is an entire film which could have been solved by one sort of 15-minute conversation with everybody involved, just sitting down and talking, and you kind of just wish that they had. Sometimes they're
is
both.
That, I'm very confused about the plot. What's yeah. So what the plot is?
So
she
the plot
comes back.
Is she has been in prison because her boyfriend / baby daddy died,
right.
And everyone blames her. I mean, not without reason, actually. But anyway, everyone blames her and she's trying to kind of reestablish herself and get into her daughter's life. And nobody wants her near the daughter because, like, she can't be trusted or whatever.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So it's kind of a nothing though. Like there's no there except for the two of them being very beautiful and flirting a bit. Like it's for a different demographic to War Machine, but the effect is similar, you know? The effect is, it's Friday night, I don't want to think, I just want to look at pictures appearing on a screen.
This'll do.
This'll do.
It's part of the this'll do cinematic universe.
That's the energy. Like, it's not, I don't know, look, there are a lot of romantic films that don't have a lot of plot, but this to me is one of the ones with the least plot that I've seen, and I just... I just didn't really care very much. I do think Micah Monroe. She's great generally. I don't think she's at her best in this film.
No,
because she just doesn't really have anything to glom onto. This character is basically just really likable, but doesn't have any particular thing.
No. Would it have improved things and zhuzhed things up if he's constantly getting calls from the NFL and she is being relentlessly pursued by a terrifying entity that will stop at nothing to eviscerate her?
Metaphorically, that's kind of what's happening because he's a former NFL star. So if you want this to be part of the Him universe, it genuinely could be.
Wow.
But he doesn't mention any sort of demonic killing sprees or whatever.
But she is pursued by her past demons.
Exactly, you see?
So he's going to star next in Him Follows.
Yes.
That's exciting.
I do think he's good. I just don't think he's good in this film.
Oh. She giveth and she taketh away.
No, it's not that he's bad, but like there's nothing.
Sounds like he's bad.
His character is just like a blank, pleasant-looking space who is very nice to everybody. Like, there's no real conflict.
Anyway, we agreed with Helen, and we have given us two official Empire stars. From Reminders of Him to How to Make a Killing, starring Glenn Powell. Glenn Powell and Margaret Qualley. Hell's bells.
So this was described by the director at the screening I saw as a quote-unquote loose remake of Kind Hearts and Coronets, one of the great dark comedies of all time, an Ealing Studios masterpiece. Mm-hmm. It is actually, in my opinion, quite a quote-unquote tight remake of Kind Hearts and Coronets. So Glenn Powell...
Well, what do you mean tight?
As in it's quite faithful to the original.
Ah. Glenn Powell plays 8 different people in this particular film.
No, of course, he's in the other role, James. As I think you know, obviously he's in the Dennis Price role. James, come on, be serious.
Rookie era.
Anyway, so this is, yes, Glenn Powell starring as a young man who was disowned at birth by his family because his mother got pregnant as a teenager, basically. And the rich family have cast her and by extension him out on the
cast you out. I cast you out. You're a vain, feedy, cruel boy.
And he grows up and through a series of unfortunate events decides that his way to become, you know, prosperous and happy in life is to knock them all off one by one until he is the sole heir to the estate, because there is an irrevocable will that means that, you know, a blood heir will inherit. So he just has to knock off eight other people and then they can
get away with
stop it.
And is that a spree or is that serial?
I would say serial. Yeah.
He just has an unconventional motive.
Yeah. So this is written and directed by John Patton Ford, who has taken the unusual step, I think, of not casting one person as every single person in the family. So this is, I guess, the big point of difference between this and Kind Hearts and Coronets. Plus, it's a modern day thing set in the US rather than the sort of Edwardian thing set in upper class London. You also have the wild card of Margaret Qualley's Julia, who is a sort of childhood friend of Glenn's, Beckett, who has grown up to be very seductive, but to marry someone she thought was rich and is now on the hunt for someone actually rich. And then you have a whole list of, a laundry list, basically, of family members to be killed, led by Ed Harris as the patriarch of the bunch. This really is quite beat for beat, Kind Hearts and Coronets. Like, not all the kills are the same, but they're often very similar. So, you know, in Kind Hearts and Coronets, one of the first murders happens in a rowing boat, basically going over Weir, and so somebody is drowned that way. On this, it's a yacht. So they've obviously slightly updated the financial wealth available to the top 1%, but it's the same idea, you know, and it's the same kind of person in the family. It's very, very similar in terms of the beats up until there's a couple of murders that are very different, but really the vibe is similar. The big mistake, and I think the big point of difference here, is that they've tried to make Beckett more likable. And I don't think that was the right decision. I think you need a certain amount of cynicism for this story and this film to work. And he is cynical, and he does have these moments of trying to lean into it, but they just don't want to get away from the fact that he's, you know, he's Glenn Powell. He's a very likable guy.
Do you think
it's
a casting issue?
I don't. I think he could do it, and I think the moments where they lean into it are really, really effective. But I think it's maybe that American thing of not wanting a full-on baddie as their protagonist. You really need to go full, like, House of Cards or something with this. You know, you need him to be pretty bad.
But I think these things work really well when you have clearly anti-hero is perhaps generous.
Yeah.
You know, you have a villainous protagonist, but they're made sympathetic because the people around them are so much worse. So it's all positional, isn't it?
But it is, and that can work. And that, I think, is what they're trying to do here. But I think that's a mistake for this particular story, because I think it's much more interesting if he's a bit of a rotter and they're just clueless.
This weirdly, the thing that kind of jarred with me on this is because he narrates this. It's kind of very much from his perspective. I found the narration to be quite prosaic and expository and a bit dull. And I always think, if you're going to have this kind of character, who's inherently quite fun because he's villainous, he's doing these things, you know, have a little bit of humor in the voiceover.
But that's kind of some of the cynicism that I mean is missing. So, like, there's a great line, which I'm going to slightly misquote, in the original, is, you know, him going, "It's so hard to make a neat job of killing people with whom one is not on friendly terms." You know, and it's that kind of sort of coldness or just glibness that I think is kind of missing here. Like, they're trying for it, but I just don't think they can, I don't think they can balance that with the kind of character they're trying to create.
See, I always think that like, for me, the gold stand for this is Penn Badgley in You on Netflix, who is just the most wrong'un of wrong'uns. Like, he's a serial killing, stalking sex offender, but he's very self-effacing and very funny, and the voiceover, so this, and also the people around him are just dreadful. So you find yourself being carried along by it, whereas I think something was lost for me. And for me, the voiceover, honestly, was the thing that kind of pulled me out of the movie, because I just found it just became quite grinding. Like, some of the kills are quite good, but I thought, it's quite boring. It's honestly quite boring. And I think Glenn Powell is inherently charismatic, and you do inherently sort of gravitate towards him because he's Glenn Powell. And he has a little bit of a twinkle in his eye, which I think actually kind of works. But broadly speaking, I was just like, I don't dislike this character, but I'm also not entertained by him. He's not funny. He's not amusing. So I felt like I was just kind of almost being forced to sit through these events rather than enjoying them.
I think that's not unfair. I didn't hate this. I didn't have a bad time watching
it. No,
it was fine. I was just sitting there going, this is a lesser reflection of a better film. And I thought they were going to do something really interesting by the time they got to Ed Harris, actually. And I thought there was a nub of an idea there that I think John Patton Ford has tried to add in and do something very different to the original. Yes. And then they just didn't really go there.
I quite enjoyed, however brief it was, the Ed Harris sequence, because that comes out of left field a little bit.
Yeah, but everything else was just a bit sort of by the numbers. Yeah. But I think that it is what you're saying. Like, they've made him more sincere.
Mm.
Like, he is...
And he's not fun.
He's not fun. And actually, it's weirdly less transgressive than the original, in which he was very, very clearly shagging two different women and torn between them. And in this, they have him be, again, a little bit more sincere in how he feels. And I don't know if that works.
I think the person having the most fun in this film is Margaret Qualley.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. And she's a delight when she's on screen.
Who could have played all eight roles? Who could have pulled a Guinness?
Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
You say, what? Who in this cast could play a character who takes on many personas and wears lots of disguises? That's Glenn Powell. Hitman.
That would be
honestly
amazing.
That would have been more fun.
The other answer, of course, is Pistachio Disguisey, because he is the master of disguise. Okay, so what did we give us one?
Three stars.
Three stars then for How to Make a Killing. I think on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by... Well, it's Project Hail Mary time, folks. So we'll be joined by Lord and Miller. It's only Lord and Miller. Phil Lord and Chris Miller talking about their new movie in which Ryan Gosling plays an astronaut, but not a serial or spree killer. I just want to clear that up beforehand. Anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is time to say goodbye to my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye to the Geonosis Jesus himself.
No.
The Pop and Jay Cavalier.
Absolutely not.
The spree killing June lover.
I mean,
okay, it's James Dyer. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Oh, the Pilot TV podcast.
Yeah.
What's on?
So many great things.
Is it the Russells this week? Or was that last week?
No, the Russells were last week.
Oh, you should listen to it again. Did you not hear the interview?
They were rustling.
I was too busy being furious about the lack of Ronnie Hazelhurst.
That makes sense.
I just threw my phone at the Thames. Regretted it. Then drained the Thames with one mighty gulp. It's goodbye from Ben Travis.
Goodbye. I'm going to go and do my own Mount Rushmore of Wally characters so that I'm allowed Wally on my Mount Rushmore.
Wally, Bernie, Eve.
The cockroach.
The cockroach, yeah.
Does the cockroach have a name?
I think it does. I'm going to look it up. Hal.
Hal?
Big fan of Hal's this week.
You love your Hal's, don't you? It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Oh, no. Oh boy. Hello. Toodaloo. Bye-bye.
Hi, Helen. Oh. We finished the podcast now.
Okay. Do we do the podcast again? Hello, Helen. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. How
Please,
are you?
Nothing good.
That'd be the worst Groundhog Day ever.
This week's question comes from our Discord channel, and it is a cracking question. It is about Mount Rushmore of movie astronauts. First of all, what is an astronaut? How would you define an astronaut, Helen?
We're not doing it.
Okay. And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to lock the doors and make these motherfuckers record this podcast again. Word for word, we're going to get it right. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.